Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with the most amazing Joanna McClellan Glass, who turned a barren early childhood and no official training into a career as a published novelist, a filmed screenwriter, and an extraordinarily successful playwright. This is an amazing story, so hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being able to mine the gems which live inside us, even if we have not had an early childhood that encouraged the mining of these gems, even if we have had an early childhood, early life experiences that encouraged us to hide those gems, which unfortunately many of us have. And as I, as a psychotherapist, have seen over and over and over again, people who have wonderful talents, instincts, abilities, creativities, but are unaware of them because, as I said, their childhoods had either discouraged them or simply not made room for them. In my shows, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because in our culture, to devote a life to an art is a difficult thing. There's very little encouragement from the culture. So in order to do that, it has to be exactly who you really are. You can't feign that. No one would. It's too difficult. And you hear in all the interviews I do, the what you see is what you got aspect of the artist I'm interviewing. And today is not only no exception. Today, my interview with Joanna McClellan Glass is essentially the role model, the poster child for what I am talking about. As I said in the opening, Joanna had a childhood barren of anything remotely encouraging to her skill and talent as a writer. But she managed to find, and you'll hear in the interview, the universe conspire to help her to find the gem of her amazing skill as a writer in virtually every venue that there is. Not only did Joanna not have luck in her family of origin, not only did she not study in any formal way, but she didn't actually begin to find her voice, use her voice, until she was a divorced single mother of young children. And you will hear her talk about her recognition that she simply could not wait for inspiration. She simply needed to do it. This is a wonderful story. This is the story of someone who was and continues to be focused, aware of who she is. Joanna McClellan Glass is a writer, and she has overcome everything in her life that didn't contribute to that, and she has used all of it as grist for her mill. And I know you will find this not only interesting and fascinating as I did, but I hope inspiring. And so here now, Joanna McClellan Glass. I am here with Joanna McClellan Glass. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. It is my understanding that the art to which you have mostly given your life is theater. Is that correct?
Yes.
I ask only one question. When was the very first time in your life that it occurred to you that writing or stories or making up things would be something attractive to you? Do you know what I'm asking?
Yes. Well, I think my first colliding with language, with really interesting language, probably came early on from my father, who knew a lot of the poetry of Bobby Burns. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Western Canada. And Western Canada, at the time that I grew up, was very British colonial. So even, you know, in high school, for instance, we didn't study anything American. We studied Byron, Shelley, Coleridge,
yes.
Keats.
Okay, wait, I want to back you up. When you say your father was fond of Bobby Burns, do you mean that he read to you? Do you mean that he suggested you read? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I've written a play called Play Memory, and it got a Tony nomination in the 80s, and it is about this father, who was a chronic alcoholic. Yeah. Chronic in a way that, I mean, he stayed home and drank, and a bootlegger, didn't have anything to do with prohibition. But in Canada at the time, there were limited hours during the day when you could buy liquor. And so our situation was very, very bad. It got to be a case of a bootlegger coming to the house and then my father giving him golf clubs, or we had Winchester rifles, my mother's china. It all went to this bootlegger. So my father, in the good times, which was when he had a few drinks, had memorized a great deal of Bobby Burns. My heart's in the highlands, my heart is not here, my heart's in the highlands, a-chasing the deer. I just remember all of this.
No kidding. You know, from, so he would speak it.
Yes,
right?
he would speak it.
Right.
And in my town of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, there was a university, and many of the men who taught there were very well-educated Brits who did not have the so-called received accent.
Wow.
And many of them brought wives with them. And it seems to me that nearly all of those women started little Shakespeare groups, little recitation groups. We had to learn Seven Ages of Man. I think it was in fourth grade that I had to get up and recite that. And you didn't understand what I was doing. But I valued it. I valued the Shakespearean language. I just knew somehow that there was something. I suppose it's like when you first hear Mozart or something and you think, what is this really all about? There's something very elevated going on here. And a lot of these people started little theater groups too. Mm-hmm. So the whole business of language on the stage and being spoken properly, very, very early on, early in school, we put on school plays. The other thing is, it's almost corny to talk about it because it has been so well documented that so often kids in very difficult domestic situations just simply live in the imagination.
Yeah.
But it often is the arts. It often will mm-hmm. be the violin or the piano, or it'll be dance.
Or singing or dance, right.
But it's all escape of some kind.
So can you find that in your own life? Do you see yourself running off into a corner and writing or something?
Yearning to. And then I was extremely lucky right out of high school in Saskatoon to get a job as a writer at a radio station. And I was 18. There was a woman who was a writer at that station who had seen me do a couple of little things on the stage and who knew that I was sort of straight A's in literature and history too, and knew my domestic situation.
Right.
And on top of the alcoholic father, I had a totally illiterate mother, a prairie woman who had been a homesteader. She had come from a homesteader. To homestead on the prairie meant that the government gave you 180 acres and your family had to land there, build a house there, and farm there.
Right.
And she came out of that family. And she had been taken out of school in grade 2 to mind young kids and had memories of what she would always call wild Indians, not just Indians coming across the horizon, but wild Indians. And so it was a very odd situation with mom and dad. The more sort of pivotal thing was the escape into writing.
And I don't think that's corny at all. I think that's very much to the point.
It's whatever, the artist in the garret, But Robert Anderson, who wrote Tea and Sympathy, said two things that I always remember. He said, you can make a killing on Broadway, but you can't make a living.
Yes, I do.
And that has always stuck with me. And then he also said at one point that the measure of a play is the measure of the writer. In other words, there really can't be anything in the material that you produce that you haven't experienced in some way.
Yes, that comes out of you.
Or questioned in some way that comes out of you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So obviously the more complex you are, probably the more screwed up you are, and the more that you have to say. But it's such a combination of I know people who are so almost debilitatingly shy. Mm-hmm. They have a great deal to say, but it's so buried, It's the river that runs deep.
Yes.
And you can't get the stuff out because life somehow has given facades and protection.
Or taboos. I do think that you're talking about an interesting dichotomy. The fact that a difficult childhood, a scary childhood, an environment that is something you want to escape from can trigger, by way of escape, submersion into one or another art. But if the debilitating aspect of the environment is so great, then you can't express it. So it's a kind of a delicate balance.
Yes.
That you seem to have gotten the best of both. You got the circumstance which forced you, encouraged you, whatever, to hide in fiction, to hide in words, to hide in stories, to imagine theatricality, you know. But you did, but it didn't shut you down. It allowed, you know, somewhere you got permission to let it out.
Yes, and that's a mystery, you know. I mean, it can be, for instance, you know, we all have a great teacher at some point.
Do you have someone
really
in mind?
Turned us on. Yes, he was a most unattractive and really kind of hapless character. I think it was in 10th grade.
10th grade, that's already, so what are you, 16, 17, 18?
Yes. Well, again, you see, I didn't have anything in the house, really. It was probably in about fourth grade in school that Miss Wilson read, for 2 years actually, read Anne of Green Gables to us. So oddly enough, that was an influence too.
No, I think...
Again, because my mother couldn't read, so I didn't have any kind of bedtime reading or any of that. And maybe that's one of the reasons why the language, the Bobby Burns stuff, kind of stuck out as something that was very appealing.
Yes.
To me.
God, this really is interesting because it does seem that you came out of, I can't think of the word, a barren,
yes.
You know, I mean, in terms of language or reading or stories or literature or any of that, it was, your home life was barren except for your father's attachment to that poetry.
Yes, and having to go to work very early on, too, sort of part-time, taking care of children and such, starting at about 11. And then when I was 15, a very nice lawyer who lived on our street actually lied for me, which I always thought was kind of ironic that he was a lawyer. But he knew my situation, he knew my family situation, and he vouched that I was 16 and sent a letter of reference off to the next province west is Alberta. And there was a summer resort there called Waterton Lakes, which is right down on the border with Montana. So every year during high school, I would request to take the final exams early in May so that I could then leave and go and spend 3 months waitressing.
Lovely.
In the summer. So I did that at Waterton. I don't know whether you really want to get into something as kind of complex as Arnold Toynbee or not, but years and years ago, when I married in 1960 and my ex-husband was getting a doctorate in physics at Yale at the time, and I got very kind of ensconced in the Yale community. It was not co-ed at that time, but it became co-ed very, very quickly. Anyway, I had all sorts of information coming in just because of where I was, mm-hmm. where I was living, and most Yaleys at that time were known to marry Smithies, and I was so far from being anything, you know, like a Smithy. But I really absorbed a great deal during that period, and it had a huge influence on me. And somebody had talked to me about anti-Semitism and Arnold Toynbee, the historian, very mm-hmm. famous British historian, and I read a little bit of Toynbee, so he is much much maligned, and justifiably so, much of the time. But the thing that stuck with me about Toynbee is essentially what you're saying, and that is that he's almost able to put sort of a graph on paper as to, how to explain it, the degree of difficulty through history that various civilizations endure and whether or not they triumph or whether they disappear, such as the Incas, for mm-hmm. instance. Nobody really
knows,
understands whether
what
that
happened.
Was an epidemic or,
right.
or what. And I think that this is really two-bit psychology, this is like 10-cent psychology. I think that perhaps part of his problem with Jews is the exact opposite of of any kind of anti-Semitism. In, it's almost a kind of envy in that
they just
he uses
managed to
the Jews as time after time after right. time. It's like sort of sandpaper wearing against you. And at some point, you can't take it any longer, and you evolve into something else, or you move. Or you learn what it is that's necessary in order for you not to do that again.
Right.
And he uses the Jews as the sort of, you know, single best example.
Yeah, role model.
Of, yeah.
Poster child.
Yes. We're way off.
Well, I don't think we actually are. I think that the reason that you went there was right off of the discussion of this balancing thing. You know, the question of too much
and
not enough, right?
What makes you go under and what makes
and
you
what makes
swim
you
somehow.
That exactly. And so somehow you had a perfect balance. I don't mean to suggest that the only way to become a dedicated writer is to have an alcoholic father and an illiterate mother. I don't mean to suggest that at all, but I do think that for you, anyway, it was the sandpaper. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the grist for your mill, and something about you, in the way that Toynbee talks about the Jews, you know, something about you was able to use what you had in the best possible way for you. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Do you disagree?
No, I agree, but I think it's very, very hard to really pinpoint how, you know, how that happens.
Well, I don't think we really have to pinpoint it. And I don't think it's necessary. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we need to extrapolate to, for anybody else either. Only that it's interesting, for me anyway, that this is what you had and this is what you made of it.
Mm-hmm.
And one might have thought, and in lots of cases I'm sure it's true, that someone else having this would not have made that of it. Is that too convoluted a sentence?
Well, no. There is a very strange kind of pride that you have that is probably not really a good thing. I mean, it goeth before a fall kind of thing. I remember when my first novel was published. And at that time, well, it's still, Knopf was a very prestigious publishing house, and Robert Gottlieb was the editor, and he had, at that time, fairly recently just come off of Catch 22 with Joseph Heller, so I was in very august company with Bob Gottlieb. And again, a terrific piece of luck there, because he had been sort of obliged to go with his wife. His wife was an actress, is an actress named Maria Tucci. And Maria had run into my friend, Austin Pendleton, on the street. And she said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm directing 2 one-act plays by Joanna Glass. If you have a chance, come and see them at Manhattan Theater Club." So Maria kind of prodded Gottlieb into going to seeing these one-act plays, and about 2 days later, my agent got a call from Gottlieb saying, "Has she ever written a novel? I'd be interested." So you don't start out that way too frequently. Usually it's, you know, 30 rejections have to arrive before somebody shows any interest. Yeah, so that.
But had you'd already written the novel?
No, plays. It was just these 2 one-act plays.
Were they your first one-act, your first plays?
Yes.
He asked, "Has she written a novel?" And then you wrote a novel?
No, then Lucy called me up and said, she said, "I can't believe this. Gottlieb has asked."
Right.
And she said, "Didn't you mention to me that you might want to try and write a novel?" So I said, yes, I do have an idea. So then he flew me in, and I just verbally went over what the idea was. A novel called Reflections on a Mountain Summer. And so we went ahead with that. And then it actually sold to the movies, but it was never made. But the point I'm trying to make is that there used to be a saying around Yale about girls who went to Seven Sisters schools, to Ivy League schools, as being tweed girls with paisley belly buttons. And I always really kind of loved that. And so going to Knopf, there was a Radcliffe girl who was given my manuscript to just be sure that all the spelling, and, you know, to
right.
sort of check it out.
Right.
And, you know, that was one of those moments where an extremely complicated moment for me, because I have such, I continue to have such envy of those girls.
Yes.
Those well-cared-for girls, yes, and well-educated girls.
Who didn't and have to struggle same, and fight and bite and have,
yes,
right?
And just end up at, you know, Knopf, and then right, they're in the New York Times when they get married, and all of that. So that sort of off-kilter in your mind with, gee, it's my novel, and she's correcting my...
Yes. On the other hand, it's your novel.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's one of those,
yes,
things,
absolutely,
that you have to kind of really examine what's going on.
It's what it says to me is that this is the reason you're such a good playwright. It's because you're so sensitive to nuance. You're so aware of complexity. You don't miss the undercurrents. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, that's not a good way to live.
Well, it may not be a good way to live, but I'm sure it makes a good playwright.
Yeah, I think certainly it helps. Yeah, I mean, the scars are sort of always there. Some of it, sometimes in writing play memory about my dad, for instance, I mean, the strange thing about that was my agent got a call from Hal Prince, who had read it. And he couldn't be more, I mean, Hal is, you know, Mr. Musical, Mr.
Yeah.
Broadway.
Right.
It was Hal who directed it. We opened at Princeton. Then we opened in, well, we got, this is one of my really, my old wounds, is that the New York Times sent a critic out from the New York Times out to Princeton. A second stringer whose name was Alvin Klein, and he gave us this rave review that I was the next Tennessee Williams, and Hal had done a wonderful job, and the cast was wonderful. The material was deep, and the language was good, and all of that. It was on the strength of that a whole lot of money fell into Hal's lap to move it to New York, and about 3 months later we moved it to New York. And Frank Rich, who no longer is a critic, but was known at that time as the Butcher of Broadway, hated it. In fact, he was so smug about it, and of course it was about alcoholism, and he was so smug about it that he sort of said at the end of it, even he needed a drink at the end of the evening.
And smug is not the right word for
well,
that.
Well, right.
Oh,
he just dismissed it out of hand. And so we did not get a run, and we did not, you know, pay back the investors, but it did get a Tony nomination.
This is how I hear it. You have this incredibly deprived in every conceivable way, financially, emotionally, educationally. You are living in a, whatever the opposite of supportive is, mm-hmm, environment.
Somehow I came out of it terribly interested in vocabulary and words and studying.
Yes,
words and,
this is what's so fascinating to me, that you came from two people who were not interested in it and couldn't do it, mm-hmm, and you are who you are. You
yes,
know.
Yes. Well, it's an anomaly.
It is an anomaly.
Yeah, there's no question.
It would be, I mean, just because I am inveterately curious about how that stuff happens, mm-hmm, I would like to know. Mm-hmm. And I suspect there is something which you may or may not remember, and it may not actually matter, but I suspect that there was a radio program or a person or a, I don't know, something that intrigued you, mm-hmm, that said, that's, wow, you know, I like that.
I think it's a sense. This sounds so morbid, and I don't think I'm that morbid as a person, but I think there's also a sense, especially with Shakespeare and Shakespeare's language, and Alexander Pope and 500-year-old English, that when the world seems particularly meaningless to you, that something that has lasted that long, mm-hmm, really makes sense. Not just that it has lasted that long, but that the, you know, the novel really is maybe 150, maybe I don't know, 200 years old, maybe. But the theater, and that is just basically, you know, a bunch of people with an audience somewhere, goes back 2,500 years.
Right.
So the idea of being in that profession seems to have a substance to it, to me, just because it's gone on for so long. And this is like old fart conversation here too, but that the world as I see it today is so beyond my understanding with, you know, Blackberries and iPads and pods and all of that. And the longevity of things that I value seems to be really, really threatened. Although, you know, the famous thing about the Rosetta Stone is centuries went by and no one was able to do to translate hieroglyphics from the Egyptians, and it was only Napoleon who finally found somebody around 1800 who was able to translate the Rosetta Stone, which is now in the British Library. But the first sentence on it is, "What is the matter with the younger generation?" So, you know, these are old questions. But I seemed very, very early on to value that, juxtaposed with, you know, my father basically selling stuff out from under us.
I think what you're saying is incredibly potent. The attraction to substance. Mm-hmm. Because certainly you didn't have it. You know? Mm-hmm. You had nothing virtually of substance to which you could
substance
cling.
Substance that isn't material.
No, that's exactly right.
Yes.
And therefore can't be taken away.
Yes.
Yes. So you came out of that, and then you had good luck. The person you never really did finish explaining, the hapless person in the 10th grade.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who I'm talking about?
Yes, Mr. Meyer was his name. And he would enter the room and sort of shout, give me one word to describe the poem Wild West Wind that we had been asked. And we would all be very intimidated. He was large and he was loud and he was really kind of, you know, unsightly. And nobody would ever come up with the word. And then he'd come to the head of the class and look at all of us and say, "Power." And I used to think, well, is he nuts, or what is it about him that he is so invested
in word?
Again, in something that to me was ancient. It was 18th century stuff that he was talking about. And I just loved him. I just couldn't get enough of him.
And he's still with you.
He's with me.
He's
very much
with me. So you have him. You have the lawyer who lied for you so that you could get out for the summer.
And also Austin Pendleton.
And then
Austin I met at Yale. He was a very, very bright man, and I'm going to talk about him very, very frankly. I don't know if he'll ever hear this tape or not. I'll talk about afflictions. Austin is from a very well-to-do family in Ohio, and they had done everything imaginable medically to try and stop what was an impossible stutter. And the night that I met him, it was in a green room backstage, and I had just watched a two-hour production of Waiting for Godot with Austin and Sam Waterston. And it was flawless. And then I went backstage to meet him, and he couldn't say my name. He couldn't say Joanna. It was and He's a walking miracle. When he left Yale and he announced he was going to go into New York to be an actor, and I thought, oh my God, I mean, send a care package right away. And he called me, and his first news was that he had been cast as the lead in, I think the author's name was Arthur Kopitz, and it was Oh Dad, Poor Dad. Mm-hmm. Mom has hung you in the closet,
and you're feeling so sorry.
With Joe Van Fleet, Jerome Robbins directing, and that was his first job. So he has been a tremendous influence on me. I remember sending him a draft of a play called Artichoke, and he was holed up for 3 months in a motel somewhere, I think in Nevada, making Catch-22 with Orson Welles. Mm-hmm. And he was just sort of in this motel, and he would take this, I'm giving one example. he would take the time on this motel stationery to write me a critique of what I had sent him. Artichoke was eventually done with Colleen Dewhurst in it at Longmore Theatre. But on everything that I've ever written, I send it. And he's always crazy busy. And if he, I mean, it used to be that he would write me things, but the world has changed, and so it's emails, or it's a phone chat. And so here we are sort of, 50 years later. As far as influences go, and someone really sort of dependable, I've called on Austin a lot.
Okay, so the universe also participated in your, you know, things, people came along at times when you were either needing them or open or and helped. I mean, the
yes.
whole Bob Gottlieb story, that's, you know, that's...
Bob Gottlieb, Hal Prince.
Right.
And then when, after my ex-husband got his doctorate in physics at Yale, we moved to Washington, D.C. And I have a play called Trying that has, in the last 5 years, it's had probably about 70 productions.
Wow.
One of which was at Oslo mm-hmm. about 5 years ago. David Howard was in it. And that's another something in the universe working, because I worked just for 1 year for Francis Biddle. I worked as a secretary at his home, not at his house actually, but across the backyard, what had been in Georgetown, the stable, and what had been the hayloft was his office. And he was 81. Sure that he was dying, and in fact he was. He only had that last year. And he had been Attorney General under FDR, and he was a Philadelphia Biddle. The Biddles came, I believe, in 16... I think it was around 1647, and bought from William Penn, the original Biddle, I think, bought in his... in the first volume of his autobiography, it's something like 40,000 acres of what is now New Jersey. So I wanted to write, and then I should just add that when FDR died, Truman named him chief judge at Nuremberg, of the military tribunal at Nuremberg. So there I was, sort of,
is this a two-character play?
Yes.
I saw it. I just didn't remember the name. Yes, absolutely, I saw it.
Uh-huh.
It was wonderful.
Yes, well, it's now been commissioned for a film.
Oh.
So I've done two drafts of a screenplay. Anyway, meeting Biddle, he became really a kind of my American education, because I had not, growing up in Canada, I had not really followed American stuff. You couldn't avoid in Canada, obviously. Second World War and so on, major things like that. And especially being Canadian, because the Canadians went in, as I say with quotes, in 39, because the Americans were, according to the Canadians, very tardy at getting in. The whole kind of history of the Biddles has kind of was delivered to me that year. And it's not, you saw it, so it's not an historical play at all. It's
no.
really about a Canadian girl,
yeah.
green as can be. It's about youth and
uh-huh.
age and dying
right.
and starting.
And relationships.
And that relationship.
Yeah, definitely,
yes.
definitely. I loved it.
Yeah, it was quite successful here.
Mm-hmm. So again, the point that I'm making is that serendipity,
mm-hmm.
you know, that is a mystery, as far as I'm concerned. And much as I like to find the source of mystery when I can, there are some mysteries that even I surrender to. And I do think that's a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Some people simply, it simply arrives for some people without their chasing it, without their looking for it, without their even knowing that this is going to be important
mm-hmm.
to them. It arrives, and that's what it seems to me has happened to you.
I suppose, and I've never really thought about this, but I suppose it's absolutely inevitable, almost from a scientific point of view, that if you think of any equation where such and such equals such and such,
mm-hmm.
the minute that any element is introduced, it all changes.
Well, yes, I think that's right. I think that, don't they say in quantum physics that the experiment is impacted by the observation of the experimenter?
Yeah, in fact, that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, that you can't leave that out.
Yes,
right.
Yes,
right.
You can't even like our meeting.
That's exactly right.
It's beyond 6 degrees of separation.
Yes,
that is just an infinite kind of
yes.
mysterious.
And it's mysterious. That's right.
Yes,
that's right. So now to take a second and see if there's an answer to this. You have spent a life, really, with words, with ideas, with stories. Do you want to say something about what that's like, or what you think about it?
Well, I have to get into the old sort of feminist thing of the way that I began, and that is that I had 3 children in 2 years because of twins. Mm. So,
oh my God,
the having it all thing didn't even occur to me until very late. You know, I married at a time. This is not a fault of my ex-husband, but I married at a time when, you know, the first 3 years I worked and he was in graduate school. But then from then on, these 3 kids hit us quite unexpectedly. And I was housebound,
yeah, right.
And I was given an allowance every Friday night.
Mm.
I just told my husband what I needed, and he gave me that, and I did the grocery shopping and so on. When I divorced 16 years later, that's really, I would say, when I was approaching 40, I could not get a credit card because I didn't have my own bank account.
Yeah.
And I had agreed in the divorce agreement to pay half of all college. And of course they were all going to hit pretty much at the same
time.
Right. I moved to Guilford, Connecticut from Berkeley, California, and announced to the world, but mostly my agent, Lucy Kroll, that I was going to try and support this whole thing by writing. So that's not really answering your question, but I felt that I held everything at bay for a long time.
Yes.
The minute the divorce happened, I simply had to earn a living, and the idea of waiting for any kind of inspiration was laughable. I mean, you simply had to get the kids on the bus and sit at the desk,
right, right,
and do something,
right,
every day. And Lucy was very, very helpful. She was a real mentor.
You had this already, so you must have written something.
I had the 2 one-acts.
Oh, that's right.
I had the 2 one-acts, and I was just during the divorce beginning the novel, Reflections on a Mountain Summit.
Right, 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 right.
And then some time later, I did the, you know, the second novel. But I remember writing that first novel. We were in Berkeley, and I had the 3 little kids. And there was a pool at Berkeley called Strawberry Canyon. And we would go at 9 in the morning, and I'd put the kids in the pool, and I would pack a lunch, and I would sit, and I had a kind of shorthand called speed writing that I had learned in high school. And writing essentially that whole novel at Strawberry Canyon. Or, you know, when the... I had to be very careful writing at night, because I didn't think I was exhausted.
Yeah,
after
right.
a day. But then when I read the stuff that I would write, say, between 9 and 11, I'd read it the next day, and it would be such crap. Not only would it just be crap that you had to throw away, but then that became, then doubt just
yes.
came over
oh
you.
Oh my God, this is what, can I really write if
yes.
I write this
yes.
stuff?
Yes, right. I wonder what it would be like to do it in the morning, but I knew that I had several years before I had mornings.
Wow.
And so when everybody was in school, I basically, you know, said to myself, now or never,
right.
just go every day. And somebody had said to me, a page a day is a novel a year. And that just made it sound so hunky-dory.
Right.
I can do that. I actually couldn't do that, but... you know, sometimes you have five pages
and then sometimes you have five pages, right? Right.
Nothing happened.
I'm so glad you said that, because somebody is listening thinking, oh, there's something wrong with me because I can't do that.
Yes. Yes.
You know, right. I'm really glad. So I'm just curious, when you're writing and it's going well, do you love it?
I do.
Yes.
I do.
Yes, right. And that's what
it's just
that's right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's the best.
It's the best thing.
It makes it all worthwhile. I don't think I answered your question really
about what it's like to spend a life writing.
Well, it as I say, it really everything was kind of percolating up until the late 30s, and then I just really, really had to get going. And the other thing is that I didn't even have rudimentary education in this. So the restrictions of a play, having only dialogue, having essentially a minute a page. I mean, I used to hear that, oh gee, if you're 20 minutes longer than they wanted it to be, that all these people that went out to Brooklyn at night in New York would miss the subway and blah, blah, blah. And then they had union rules, and IATSE had to bring down the curtain
at a certain time when they was all going home.
Yeah, and I remember on the first screenplay that I did for Zanuck and Brown on a novel, the second novel was called Woman Wanted, and it was then made into a film. Kiefer Sutherland made it into a film. But Zanuck and Brown, at one point, I did a screenplay for them on Woman Wanted. And they sent it back and said, we're not going to read it until you cut 20 pages. Because we budget $75,000 a page before we hire anybody.
Oh, my God.
And you've got 20 pages
too long.
Yeah. So all of those, you know, I had to really learn all of that the hard way.
Really?
On the job.
Right.
It wasn't as if I went to film school, you know, and somebody said, hey,
no, but you're still making the point that that it can be done. Do you know who Michael Wilder is? He's a British writer, and he wrote a bunch of The Avengers. Do you remember
the Avengers?
Oh right?
Yes.
He told me that he is functionally illiterate, and he can't write a complete sentence, but he knew that he had good ideas for stories. And so he daydreamed a story, dictated it into a cassette player, gave it to someone to write in screenplay form, and had a career.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, that's...
But the point is that it's this limited idea of what you have to have before you can do the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't necessarily so,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What it requires is something else.
But it pours out of you somehow.
Yes.
Edward Albee was asked the question time and time and time again about how do you know, when you're ready to sit down and write. Is it a first sentence? Is it the final sentence? Is it an experience? What? And I loved his answer. He said, you know, I'm just walking down the street someday, and I know if I am with play.
I know that's right.
Yeah.
I know that.
It's like with child.
With child, exactly.
I just know it.
That's right.
Yeah. On the other hand, the mysterious and really peculiar part of it, I always think of this, there's some South African Botswana or, I don't know, frog that sees only what it needs to eat.
Wow.
It doesn't see its enemies. I mean, it's a very precarious
life.
Frog.
Yeah, right.
It just sees what it needs to keep, you know, to keep itself alive. And I often feel like that. I think, my God, I'm just constantly doing this awful editing.
Of the universe.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah, of the universe,
right.
Yes. And in Seagull, I think it's Chekhov's Seagull. What is that character's name? He's the writer. Something like Treviron. At any rate, he's a very, very successful writer. And Nina, the young, the seagull character, is essentially in love with him and a great fan. And he's very kind of jaded and sophisticated and from Petersburg. And she's out in the provinces, as the Chekhov people all tend to be. And he has this wonderful speech of kind of, you know, she's saying, oh God, it must be so wonderful to be famous and to have articles about you in the paper and so on. And he says, oh, you know, it's just that you can't look at anything without thinking, I mean, right now I'm looking up at this cloud and I'm thinking, where could I use that? And that shape of that, you know, that everything has to be grist
for the mill. You know, the famous Scott Fitzgerald line.
No.
About some relationship he was in, and it was really ghastly, but I did get a paragraph out of it.
Oh. Yes, that's wonderful too.
Yes, and it's the same thing.
Yes.
It is that you see the world in terms of what you create.
Yes. But it's a strange kind of selection, evolution kind of, again, who knows what you're going to select?
Well, but I think that image of the frog that sees what it needs to eat is so perfect.
Yes, and has no protection. And I think artists in particular have
and
no
I
protection.
And I think that's exactly right.
Because we
and
need that, to be so sensitive.
That's right. And vulnerable.
Yes.
Yes. And
while being rejected.
Often.
Yes.
Often. But if you aren't able to first be vulnerable enough to offer what is real, mm-hmm. and second, be strong enough to survive the rejection, you can't do it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, that's always been the anomaly, the paradox. You have to be sort of an arrested developer in your character in order to have the pores open to let this stuff come in.
The problem with it is that you are vulnerable to hurt, but it's a great gift to be able to stay that open, to suffer in the pursuit of your work, of your art, of what it is that you are meant to do. Boy, waxing fairly.
Yes, interesting interview.
Oh, we have to stop here with that. The perfect way for me to stop.
It seems to me we did a lot of philosophy here.
I love it. It's my favorite thing. Thank you so much, Joanna.
You're
this
welcome.
Was so wonderful.
Yeah,
so there you have it. A woman who was able to take, as I say in the interview, a completely barren home life. Worse than barren. Destructive. What would have been destructive to so many other souls. A father whose alcoholism forced him to sell everything of value that the house had to offer. A mother whose early life was completely devoid of anything intellectual or creative. This is a home life that might have, should have, under most circumstances, would have turned out a person who was not only unable to find her talent, but was bitter. This is what one might have expected from a childhood like this. A resentful, bitter, solitary, and uncreative human being. But that's not what we got. Fortunately, as Joanna implies, she was able to find everything in her environment that spoke to her capacity to turn her experiences into art. When you think of her writing Play Memory, taking the experience of the painful experience of her childhood and turning it into a play that Hal Prince wants to direct, that all along that's what she's doing, even though she's not studying, she's not able to get really any critical help, the help of you know, the help of learning how to do this. You know, you hear her say she had to learn it the hard way on the job. But she did. And as we both say at different points in this interview, the ability to do that, the reason that she could do that, it's mysterious. Yes, it's mysterious, but the fact of it speaks to what I am trying to say over and over and over in these shows, that what is inside you, however hidden, however denied, however encouraged, however unnourished, it's still there. And it's available. And I do not mean to suggest that it's easy, because I know that it's not, that I spend so much of my life trying to help people do this, achieve this, access this. But it is doable, and that's what I hope you've heard from not only this amazing interview with Joanna, but with every interview I do. And so, because Joanna's interview was so long, and I was really reluctant to cut any more of it, and as you heard, I'm quite taken with the capacity to do philosophy, and not everyone will go there with me, so I didn't want to take any of that out, I didn't want to take any more out than I had to. So, of course, I don't have very much time, so I'm going to take the time to tell you that you can find not only this interview, but all of my interviews up on my website, thelynneshow.com, thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. You can also find my article on phone therapy, which is the only way I work these days, therapy on the go. You can find my book, and actually I think even listen to the first chapter, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And anything else you might want to know about me is on the website. Also, you can find, email me, so you can contact me, you can ask me any questions that you have for me, and you can ask me to get you Josh Hackney, who is my IT computer recording electronics guru, and who I am glad to thank in every show, and to tell you that if you need any of this kind of help, you want Josh, and again, you can get him at my website, thelynneshow.com. And if you social media, if you Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn, and you liked this show or anything you've heard on The Lynn Show, please do make a point of saying it there. And as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something inspiring, something encouraging, something delicious. Something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. My shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night.